Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
My guest this evening is William Ramsey. He is the author of Prophet of Evil, Aleister Crowley, 9/11, and the New World Order, and Abomination, Devil Worship and Deception in the West Memphis Three Murders. He's also the proprietor of Occult Investigations, a website dedicated to covering the role of the occult in the intrigues of the deep state and history of our country and perhaps Western civilization in general. He's also the host of the weekly program, William Ramsey Investigates, correct?
Correct.
And that's on the Awake Radio Network?
That's on Awake Radio, but you can also listen to it on my YouTube channel, which is Occult Investigations on YouTube. I have all my past shows are there.
Okay, great. Now, listen, William, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And, I want to talk to you about regarding your research regarding some of these things. Crowley, his role perhaps in shaping the 20th century. I was reading an article. Apparently he's considered, was it the 77th greatest
Englishman, yes.
Englishman, which, considering the influence of the British Empire in the modern era, that's saying a lot.
It is. I would agree with that. I was surprised to see him on that list. He's up there with some pretty important Englishmen, Churchill and the Beatles and stuff like that.
And, of course, they all have a lot in common, actually.
Well, that's true. I mean, the interesting thing about Crowley is that much of his influence is sub rosa. It's not overt, you know, and not too many people admit it, but if you're very careful, you can kind of ascertain people's influence, you know. So, but he was definitely quite an influence on the 20th century, as he intended to be. Mm-hmm. So my interest in Crowley really came out of 9/11. I was a 9/11 researcher. I'd always been a reader about stories, parapolitics, maybe deep politics, and I had been reading about everything. But 9/11 was particularly interesting. But I kept seeing these numbers at 11, actually the date of the event was 9/11, the 11th day of September. So, you know, and there were all these 11s popped up. I had read an article by a guy by the name of Captain May, who also noticed these numerical significances. And so it just led me to research, and I found out that 11 was the prime number of Aleister Crowley. But also other numbers were important too to Crowley, 93, 77, and 175. And those were the numbers of the planes in 9/11. And those buildings were 110 stories tall, basically in 11. So there's these occult numerical markers on that event, and that's what led me to Crowley. And I really wanted to figure out who Crowley was. I had a very superficial, topical knowledge of Aleister Crowley. I'd heard of him from, like, Ozzy Osbourne had a song, Aleister Crowley. I'd seen his face, and people had talked about him, but I really didn't know what he meant. I didn't know what the kind of his writings were, and it led me to just read everything I could on Crowley. I read all of his biographies that were available. I actually went to source texts. I created a timeline of his life, and it led to my first book, Prophet of Evil, Aleister Crowley, 9/11, and the New World Order. And my general thesis is that the ideas of Aleister Crowley influenced the events of 9/11, the actual day of the event, and the agenda of what the purpose of 9/11 was. So that book really traced his life, which, you know, was from 1875 to 1947 when he died. And that also led my interest into seeing what his real effect upon the culture of the 20th century was. So I started to research this book that I finally published this year, maybe 2 months ago, called Children of the Beast, which is available on my website at Cold Investigations. And while I was researching that book, I came across a video of somebody in the West Memphis murders, a guy by the name of Damien Eccles, who's kind of the head figure of the West Memphis Three, talking about Aleister Crowley. Actually, the prosecutor was asking him about Aleister Crowley because Damien Eccles had, after his arrest, he had been writing kind of a secret code referencing the name of Aleister Crowley in kind of a secret alphabet. And the prosecutor was asking him about it. And there was actually on the table of the prosecutor was Crowley's masterwork, Magic in Theory and Practice. And that led me to really investigate the West Memphis Three event. And there's tons of occult elements to that event. And one of the remarkable things about the West Memphis Three is how many celebrities are modern celebrities that we know were supporters of the West Memphis Three. People like Johnny Depp, Dave Navarro, Margaret Cho, Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam, all these people, and the director of the Hobbit movies and the Lord of the Rings movies, Peter Jackson, somebody who I just read is worth $450 million, very wealthy people. And Johnny Depp has an astronomical personal value, but they spent money. The amount of money that was spent to release the West Memphis 3 was estimated to be $10 to $20 million, which allowed them to really get the best attorneys, the best PR people, and they were released from jail. Actually, it was 5 years ago to the day on August 19th. So they've been out of jail for 5 years. They're on probation for 10 years. But I studied the case, and the general consensus was that they were innocent, they were railroaded, that they were set up, it was a witch hunt. There was all these kind of loaded terms that were bandied about. But fortunately for me, somebody had done all the legwork and all of their court materials, all of the police files, the research was on a website called Callahan AK. So being the kind of research junkie that I am, I just read all the things. And I'm like, hold on, there's tons of problems with this. I'm an attorney. I'm currently an attorney with the state of California, registered member of the bar. And when I put my legal hat on, I said, whoa, 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 there's real problems here. These guys were seen at the site. They all admitted to doing it. Jesse Miskelly, who was one of the West Memphis Three, admitted to doing it post-conviction. He told all kinds of people that they did it. So it was very clear to me that they were the right party to be put to trial. And they were all found guilty in two separate trials by two separate juries. So 24 people all came to the conclusion that they were guilty. So that was my second book, Abomination, Devil Worship and Deception. And then Children of the Beast really just covers all of the people that Aleister Crowley influenced. And it's a long list. People that, you know, you would know, like Alfred Kinsey, Arthur Clarke, but other people, and Charles Manson, believe it or not, and Jimmy Page, but people that you may not know, people like H.R. Giger, who was an artist who influenced the movie Alien, people like Harry Hay, who was the head of the homosexual revolutionary of the 20th century, was influenced by Aleister Crowley, L. Ron Hubbard, people like Ian Fleming, who really his first book had somebody who was a prototype of Aleister Crowley in it, and had actually been in contact with Crowley regarding the whole Hess affair when Hess left Adolf Hitler's regime and tried to negotiate peace with England. So there's quite a few references there in that book, and that's really the three books that I have written that are directly tied to Aleister Crowley.
So he casts a long shadow. Aleister Crowley, quickly, who was he? His date of birth, is that important? I mean,
I think it is. I think the time of his birth was very important. He was born into a very wealthy family. He was associated with a Christian sect called the Plymouth Brethren that was started by John Darby. They were kind of a dispensationalist, Darby was, and Crowley's family was part of the Exclusive Brethren, which was a subset of the Plymouth Brethren. They were supposed to be a more rigid, serious member of the Christian community. And when his father died at 12, Crowley rebelled. So he was a person, the only child. The amount of money that he inherited when his mother died was in the sum of today's terms, like $20 million. So it was a significant fund. Crowley never worked, but he was very well educated. He went to the best British schools, ended up at Cambridge or Oxford. And he really just started in his cult at a very early age. He became interested in secret societies, and he was born at a time when the English Empire really was the dominant power of the world. At the late 19th century, the sun never set on the British Empire. They owned one-fourth of the land mass of the world, and Crowley had that advantage. He circumnavigated the world twice before he was 40, and spent his time really as an occultist. That was really, he said in his very early age, he was white hot on three things: mountaineering, poetry, and magic. So he was writing poetry, practicing magic, and he was an avid mountaineer at a very early time. He tried to scale some of the tallest mountains in India, actually Nepal, that area. It was called Kanchenjunga. And so he was an adventurer. He took as his kind of guide this guy, Richard Burton, who was a adventurer before him, somebody who studied languages. He was one of the first white people to take a Hajj to Saudi Arabia, to Mecca and Medina, as a kind of undercover Muslim and wrote about it. So Crowley, kind of, that was his model. And so he became this writer. He was always involved in an early magical society that was a post-Masonic society, something beyond Masonry, called the Golden Dawn. He went all the way up that was really probably the basis of all of his occult work, was everything he learned from the Golden Dawn. And his master was a guy by the name of MacGregor Mathers, who Crowley used as kind of another influence, somebody who'd written books about the Kabbalah, the Tarot, and was a practicing magician. So Crowley became like that. They actually went in court. Mathers sued Crowley for stealing and publishing secrets from the Golden Dawn that Crowley said that he would keep quiet. He made an oath of secrecy, which he broke. But early in his life, probably the most influential event was it happened in 1904 in Egypt, where Crowley said he received the Book of the Law, which was a small pamphlet. He said he was dictated to from a god he called Awas, A-I-W-S-Z, or it was spelled in different ways. But he said it was this person who was, Awas means Lord of the Air. And it was dictated to him for 3 days over his shoulder. He said it was a preternatural intelligence that guided it to him. And that became the groundwork for much of his religion, the Crowleyanity, or everything that he would write about later, went back to the Book of the Law. And so that was something that happened in 1904. And he traveled a lot. And I think that his, you know, when I first read Crowley, I didn't really analyze his whole Secret Service stuff, but he was probably an asset of the English intelligence from a very early age, from his bright postgraduate. He was constantly traveling. He's a very difficult person to tie down. He wasn't like in his place for one period of time.
Think he was recruited at Cambridge?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. As are many, of course.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that was his, he was always an elitist. So, you know, at a very early age, he was going to Russia. He traveled to Russia before the revolution. He ended up in the U.S. for the war, World War One, where he was involved. The English really wanted the U.S. in the war in World War One, and the Germans wanted the U.S. out of war. The interesting thing is that Crowley traveled to the U.S. on the Lusitania, which the sinking of the Lusitania would actually lead to the U.S. involvement in World War One. But he traveled to, he would always go to different places. He was circumnavigating the globe, China. He'd been to India, through modern-day Vietnam. He had been all through the U.S., you know, so his travels, he was constantly moving. He'd been in Mexico. After the Golden Dawn broke down, he traveled to Mexico. And so he was it's really remarkable in that sense. You know, he never really had to die. All the time he's traveling, he's writing poetry and practicing magic and leaving magical records. So it's really one interesting aspect of Crowley that makes it difficult to really put a finger on him. But he was in England. He was in the United States working as a spook, and I think Richard Spence wrote Secret Agent 666, which really provided one key piece of evidence about Crowley, where he found Richard Spence found in American records that there was a writing that said about Crowley, he is working for the English intelligence with the full knowledge of the United States. That's a paraphrase for what it was stated, but there was a record in there.
Wasn't his overt role playing a role of like Irish nationalist and pro-German?
Exactly. So he had these ridiculous things he would do about. He actually did this stunt that was actually published in the New York Times, and that article is available. But Crowley went out to the Statue of Liberty and tore up his English passport and proclaimed, you know, the freedom for the Irish nationalists, and threw his passport into the water. He wanted to do that stunt on the Statue of Liberty, but he didn't get the proper permit. So he was on a boat with his girlfriend at the time, a girl by the name of Lila Waddell, was Scarlet Woman at the time. While she was playing, she was an accomplished violinist, so she was playing the violin while Crowley was doing this. And he would do these public stunts often, so you would see these writings that were, he was kind of like a celebrity kind of publicity hound of that era, you know, so trying to do things to get in the papers and stuff like that. So, you know, getting back to Crowley, always traveling, always writing. There's tons of literature. He wrote for Vanity Fair. That magazine is still around, but 100 years ago, Crowley was writing for them under his name and under pen names. And he was an excellent prose writer. I mean, really, I guess he was at the top of his form in that era when writing was much more prized than it is today. Mm-hmm. And, so he left this just voluminous records that nobody, not even his admirers or his other biographers, have really effectively compiled all of his writings, because he wrote under different names and things like that. But there are good bibliographies that include a lot of stuff, but some stuff is missing. But his most important book was The Book of the Law, and also Magic and Theory and Practice, which he wrote in the 30s, which encompassed a lot of his magical techniques and ideas. But he all the time was trying to find disciples, and people came to him, and he had a wide variety of wealthy disciples. He didn't believe of dealing with anybody from the middle, and this is kind of an exemplar of his elitist mentality. He never really dealt with people who were middle or lower class, but he would find people from wealthy families or people who went to the best schools and train them. So he had this variety of followers. J.F.C. Fuller was one, Victor Newberg, people who you might not know, Gerald York, but all these guys came from wealthy families. But J.F.C. Fuller was interesting because he actually went on to influence the German high command. His ideas of massed military infantry or massed military assaults with armor influenced the German high command, and actually his ideas led to the Nazi triumphs, believe it or not. He actually met with one of Hitler's top generals, a guy by the name of Guderian. And he was one, J.F.C. Fuller was one of two people who was invited to Hitler's 50th birthday in Berlin. So there's interesting connections between a lot of people that Crowley knew and Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, believe it or not. Crowley was in the Weimar Republic from 1930 to 33, probably acting as a spy, hanging out with other known spies in the kind of lead up to Hitler's ascent to power. And I think he left in a very close association to when Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. So it's a fascinating aspect of Crowley's life. You know, and Crowley was kicked out of Italy by Mussolini. So he has these contacts and interests with all these dictators of that era. Crowley, after he left, Britain achieved the goal of getting the U.S. into the war against the Germans, Crowley left the United States, traveled back to Britain, and ended up in Italy. And he created what he called the Abbey of Philema, the Abbey of the Will. Philema and Agape were two important Greek words to Crowley. Both of them Kabbalistically added up to 93. But Philema means will, agape, love. And Crowley believed in his personal will. That was the most important thing, is to focus the will to get what you want and achieve what you want to do. But the Abbey of Philema functioned for 3 years. People from all over the world came and traveled there to learn at the foot of the beast. And there are pretty good records of people who had traveled there, and they include them in Prophet of Evil. But there was a magical floor. There were magical workings there. There were artwork all across the walls. And eventually, and Crowley would come and go there. He would travel to northern Africa, travel all the way. He actually, interestingly, was in Rome. And this is probably another exemplar of his assignment as an intelligence asset. He was in Rome for 3 days watching Mussolini and his black shirts take over the Italian government, which is another fascinating correlation. Of Crowley was kind of like a zealot type figure. He knew a lot of the known culturally important people, but he was also in these funny places at the right time. So in 1923, Mussolini gets tired of his antics, kicks him out of Italy. He has to abandon everything. All his followers flee. He travels to Tunisia and eventually makes his way back to Paris. He lives in Paris with a guy by the name of Frank Harris and his wife, Keefe, I think her name was. And there he is probably, they think, the French think he's an asset of German intelligence. And he's doing all kinds of magical workings. And that's where he's rumored to have met this woman by the name of Pauline Pierce. Or Pauline Robinson, who became Pauline Pierce.
And this connects to?
Barbara Bush. So she comes back. She comes, supposedly comes back. Now, the fact is that at the time Crowley is in France, he's involved in all kinds of rituals that require servitors. He was doing something called, I mean, the details are rather lurid, but ECL, which stands for Erato Comatose Lucidity. So they needed to have all these women, and she was rumored to be one of the women, and the timing is right. Actually, all the numbers work perfectly together of her coming back pregnant with a daughter who looks exactly like her. And it's important to remember, too, that the elites at that era wanted to go to France. That was kind of like the 20s were an important era of the City of Lights. All these writers and artists were all there. And so it was really the place to be. And Crowley really was attracted to those type of things as well. Hemingway is there. And anyway, so Crowley eventually gets kicked out of France. 1929, gets kicked out of France, has to flee back to England. All these times that he's kicked out, he's still able to come back to England. So all these notions that he was anti-British or anything, he was always allowed back into his home country, which should tell you a lot, or tell the public a lot. So then he ends up there. 1929, goes back to Germany. He's in Germany for 3 years. Hitler comes to power. He leaves and eventually ends up, he travels around more, has all kinds of ridiculous lawsuits. Ends up in a boarding home for the rest of his life until he died in 1947 in the south of England in Hastings, kind of upper-end boarding home. And all the time, bringing followers, trying to find more disciples, running the OTO, he became the head of the German OTO, which stands for Ordo Templi Orientis, which is a German secret society that Crowley became head of in 1925, which is interesting. The Germans made him the head of the British segment of the OTO, sometime earlier, maybe a decade or two earlier, but when the heads of the OTO died, who were German, he became the head, and then integrated all of his ideas into their secret society doctrines, drug usage, sex magic, etc. So that's basically the long and short of Aleister Crowley. Now, why is Crowley important? There were other type of occultists, other people, the Masons, people like Manly P. Hall, Albert Pike, Blavatsky. Why aren't they referenced by the modern occultists as much as Aleister Crowley? What makes him different? And I think what made him different than them is that he was actually a person who, because of his free time, he left a large repository of magical practices that and dictums and things to that other people could learn from that these other people may not have done so well. People like Blavatsky, who wrote these thick tomes, or Manly P. Hall, who didn't really have kind of magical guide or framework to my knowledge, or, you know, these other people who were kind of historians. Crowley was like a person who put things into place where people could act through the OTO, through his works, and through his magical fraternity he called the AA, the Argem Astrum, or Silver Star. So I think that, and that Crowley had this doctrine of permissiveness that allowed people to achieve whatever they want and really have no restraints. I think that that was kind of Crowley's dictum, do what thou wilt shall be the whole law, an 11-letter phrase that he repeated all the time. And I think that that was his attraction to this day. And that's why all these music bands, artists, politicians, and people reference Aleister Crowley. And I include a lot of those people in my book, Children of the Beast.
Yeah, the doctrine of do what thou wilt. Didn't he also paint that on along the Hudson River in New York when he was
correct?
Yeah.
So when he was in New York, he traveled up. He told people he wanted to take a magical retirement, but some of his followers said he just wanted to get out of the heat of New York. So he traveled up the Hudson River and stayed at an island called Esopus, Eospos, I think it's called. But while he was up there, there were two bluffs at some point in the Hudson River, and on one side he wrote, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, and then on the other he wrote a dictum from the Book of the Law, which is every man and woman is a star.
And this is not too far away from what would become the scene for the Woodstock Rock Festival of 1969.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's right up there close to, what's the military base up there, or the military? It is, let me look it up. That's Esopus Island. Yeah, but yeah, so he was up there. It's Esopus Island. That's where he was close to, which is still there. And, you know, it's just a remarkable piece. A lot of people wouldn't tie Crowley to the United States, but, you know, that's his a little north of West Point.
Okay. See. Now, what's interesting is Crowley is, he's one of these figures like John Dee, connects the occult to the world of intelligence, yes. And whether it's magic, secrecy. Now, a lot of these can be done through sleight of hand, conjuring, which requires a sort of occulted knowledge. And now, Crowley himself is sort of a self-promoter, and some say some of his reputation for being evil he helped promote. He was kind of like, so much of his life it could be semi-mythological, because one of the things I think just the point Richard Spence makes in his book Agent 666 is that the problem with these figures is they're also liars.
I mean, if you run, I came across so many people. I tried to really put Crowley in place by people, secondary sources who had met him, and almost every time they say he's boasting. They don't really know what's the truth. Somerset Maugham, who's a famous writer of Razor's Edge, said, you know, he just kept talking and talking. Some of it was true, some of it was not. It reminded me actually a lot of what people said about L. Ron Hubbard, is like they just can't stop talking. But, you know, there was another guy, a guy by the name of Lance Siefking, who I included in my book, and he says, I sat there and listened as Crowley talked and talked and talked. He had an air of treating me as though I was an initiate in his cult. You know, so they just all said the same thing. And I think that was kind of the way he controlled people, is he just kept talking and talking and talking, and they just drone on, and the people just either come under his spell or whatever. But yeah, I think it is hard. Crowley is hard, but I think you can put a finger on him. I think in my book, Prophet of Evil, I got a good idea, because there were so many people who met him in first hand and gave first hand accounts. And nobody really ever said, oh, I trusted him.
Yeah.
But they all gave, I think, credible accounts. Like there's this one girl, Betty May, who's her boyfriend actually ended up dying at the Abbey of Thelema. And she gave firsthand accounts of Crowley in England. She gave firsthand accounts of him in the Abbey of Thelema. But I think it was all credible. And, you know, they say the same thing. He talked. He had an impression on people. He was strange, and they were afraid of him. You know, and I think that was fairly consistent with people who had met him for 20 years.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview with Richard Spence that done on Jay Dyer's show, and he was talking about his book. He was talking about Dennis Wheatley, had this to say about Crowley. He said, I'd never leave him alone with my children, nor would I ever lend him money.
Yeah. Well, at the end of his, he was actually, one of the interesting things about Crowley is somebody who thought he was very important had a really terrible relationship with money. And at the end of his life, he had spent all of his money, and he was always trying to grift money from people through one way or another, whether it was followers or lawsuits.
Didn't Anton LaVey end up broke too?
That's what I heard.
Yeah, so I think it's
really
funny.
I don't really know the thing, but for sure Crowley was broke. And but Wheatley, you know, they were all took an interest in it. I concluded Dennis Wheatley in my book about Children of the Beast, because he's an important figure too. He was kind of like the Stephen King of his era, and sold 6 million books in the millions, like tens of millions, and met Crowley. Wheatley was friends with Ian Fleming, and his books were all had characters who were influenced by Crowley. Devil's Ride Out was this guy, Villain Mokata, who, if you watch this movie, The Devil Rides Out, I suggest people who want to get an idea of what Crowley looked like. This was another Crowley figure. Like Fleming had this one guy by the name of Le Chiff. Wheatley's was Mokata, and Mokata said the same things as Crowley, modeled on Aleister Crowley. In magic, there is nothing good or evil. It is merely a science, the science of causing change to occur by means of one's will. That's right out of Crowley's lexicon, you know. And Dennis Wheatley's Gregory Sallust was the influence upon Ian Fleming's James Bond. And so Wheatley, you know, it's very interesting. A lot of these guys really knew him, and he knew Tom Dryberg, who was actually supposed to be Aleister Crowley's heir, which is another interesting character. A lot of people in England know him, but the people in the U.S. don't. But, here's what Wheatley says about Crowley. His conversation was fascinating. He gave me much useful information in several of his books, but never tried to draw me into his occult activities. So that's a very consistent thing about his fascinating conversation.
Well, I mean, one thing I was listening to, I've listened to your interviews regarding Crowley, and also Dr. Spence and his book. And what I seem to get out of it is that Crowley himself was an asset. And given he had these connections to these, you know, I guess you could say these transnational cult societies, secret societies, mm-hmm. that all have certain intelligence utility, whether it's his travels, right. his knowledge of certain – I mean, if you're a global empire, you want to have certain anthropological, you know, knowledge of the areas you're trying to control or conquer. Right. And someone like a Crowley would be very good in not only providing that information but also how to engage in, you know, what would have been, you know, psychological warfare, which the British were adept at. But given Crowley's connections to, you know, Dennis Wheatley, Ian Fleming, Somerset Maugham, the British establishment, British intelligence, what does that say about the Anglo-American establishment?
Is that they're willing to use occultists for expedience, you know? I think that that is common, and I actually think in the United States, if you look at a lot of the people who run the CIA, they all come out of Skull and Bones. I mean, how many members of Skull and Bones signed the National Security Agreement in 1947? There's like a famous picture of them. It's like Skull and Bones, Skull and Bones, which is an occult society. George W. Bush, both Bush Sr. and Jr., Skull and Bones. So there's a lot of people out there with secret knowledge, like Crowley, who are elements of the state, you know, who are assets of the state. Yeah. And I think even going back, you mentioned John Dee. Here you go with this guy who's like the most knowledgeable man in Europe at the time with the largest library is, you know, sitting with Queen Elizabeth, right? So I think that if you look back in history, even if you go into the Old Testament, whether you want to talk about like Daniel, the book of Daniel, who the kings have these soothsayers and astrologers, I think that as actually the rule as opposed to, you know, something unique, that a lot of these powerful people have people who would ascribe to ideas that Crowley did, who would do their bidding of the state without without any kind of moral qualms.
Yes.
Here's a perfect thing, like this guy Steve King I was talking about. He said that Crowley said to him, "If you want to find the men who have crossed my path, the men who have wronged me, you have but three places in which to look: the jail, the madhouse, and the grave." So this is a guy Crowley bragging in like 1929 that, you know, this is what happens to his enemies. And I think that's an ideal person. If you have a state and you have to get something done, that's an ideal person you want to put a task to, right?
Yes.
So,
yes. Interesting. Yeah. So here he is. I mean, he's a He's linked to intelligence, and we've said why that's important. And historically, there've been other, I guess, similar figures who, like John Dee, who have ties to intelligence. Right. To the state and court intrigues, you know, geopolitics and all that. But if you look at the secret societies, whether if you want to call it the CIA secret society, I think that's fine. But they're an outgrowth of Skull and Bones and sort of the Eastern establishment.
True.
And the CIA was formed to pursue their interests and wrap it in the American flag.
Right. And say that we're there to have a thing. But I would totally agree with that. I think that they had an internal agenda and an external agenda. I think, what did Truman say, that the signing of the NSA was the biggest mistake he ever made or something?
Yes, yeah. As if he had a choice.
Right. True, well, good point.
if you do a history of the intelligence agencies, whether it's MI6, which is really what, SIS, I think?
SAS, yeah. SAS, MI6, MI5, and then it was the OSS to the CIA. Mm-hmm.
But they're all linked to ultimately to the banking and financial interests that comprise the Anglo-American empire today, but grew out of the opium slave trade and these things.
All these kind of dirty kind of international intrigue type stuff. I agree. Look at Ian Fleming. He came out of a banking family, the Fleming family.
Yeah.
And they were privileged kids who went to Eton, he and his brother. And, you know, then he really, that's probably why he got his job at a very important, and he probably was an asset from a very early age.
Yeah.
He has all the elements of an intelligence asset from the beginning, a journalist who traveled to Germany. And so it wasn't like he just showed up at 10 Downing Street to be an asset for the naval asset, the one of the biggest, Godfrey, who was the head of the naval division in England, you know, probably the most important, like their important part of their military branches. So here's another aspect. So a banking guy who's an intelligence asset working for the interests of the British Empire.
And here in the United States, the CIA's precursor was the OSS, which is Office of Strategic Services. But some people said it stood for Oh So Social.
Right. A good point. Because, yeah. And you know, the interesting thing is that when Fleming was in the United States, he wrote the setup for the CIA. I mean, basically, yeah. A lot of that, the you know, skeletal elements of what would create be the CIA was drafted by some British guy.
Yeah, that goes to this sort of this effort made by the British in the latter half of the 19th century was to reincorporate the United States into the Anglo fold, and they were largely successful. I mean, that's with the Pilgrim Society, the Union Now Society. This was done, aided pretty much with the development of the telegraph, steamship, and these things. But the, I guess, you know, the Eastern establishment was always kind of Anglophile. So, pretty, that was, you know, once they controlled the newspapers and the media of the day. And I think if you look at Hollywood, if basically as it developed in the run up to the Second World War, it was largely, you know, it was pro-British. You know, right. You had the Quarter Circle, and you also had that other opera guy who ran Paramount. What was his name?
I wish I knew.
Reese, not Reisman. But his job was to make sure they produced a bunch of pro-British movies.
Right.
Yeah. But that, I mean, that's what maybe you mentioned about Crowley, what he's doing. He's here in the United States as an agent, as a British agent.
Right. I mean, involved in what was the most important kind of mind influencing things at the time, which were magazines and newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
So he's working for the Fatherland. He admitted in his confessions, the 500-page, you know, autobiography, that he was there as to make his arguments of the Germans absurd. You know,
yeah,
make the Germans look ridiculous, and he said he achieved it. So I think, you know, that's just one asset that you know, and that's interesting thing about intelligence. You don't know who the assets are.
Yeah, and British propaganda was always so much more subtle and effective than, say, German propaganda, which tended to be overt.
Yeah, I think you're right. Actually, the English are incredible, man. The British Empire, the reason that the empire was so big and effective on this minority population is that they were incredibly clever.
Yes.
You know, they did all kinds of manipulation. They put people against each other.
They took over the world in a fit of absence. That's what they say, right?
Interesting, yeah.
So, but they had a hold on the American mind. I mean, they're the ones that burned the White House in 1814, yet... A century later, United States is going to war to save the British Empire twice.
It's incredible, man. Yeah. You know, I've actually taken a tour of the White House when I was in D.C. from 95 to 98. I knew family members worked at the White House, so I took that tour and sat there. And there's a place on the old underbelly of the White House still exists. And you can see the char marks from the burning of 1814 when the Brits came and burned the whole thing. They're still there.
Yes.
They're literally right there. I was sitting right there, and the guy I put my hand on, I was just like, whoa, this is incredible. It's just a total piece of history right next to where they have the underground bowling alley and all that stuff.
But if you look at the American flag, it actually is it's a virtual copy of the British East India Company flag.
Interesting.
And again, we mentioned Yale, Skull and Bones, and Yale, you know, Yale was named after a man who worked for the British East India Company. So the Eastern establishment always had these ties. This goes back to, you know, the Russell family and the opium trade when they more or less went into business with the British, you know, with the clipper ships and all and this affects, you know, China, because that became, not only did it become a means to reverse the balance of trade between China and Great Britain for the tea, it also opium became a weapon to make China vulnerable for penetration, ultimately, you know, exploitation by the British. And people have done research on people like Mao, revolutionaries, who actually was a Yalie.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that's
when was Mao in Yale?
Well, he went to school at Yale ran a bunch of missions in China.
Right.
And he attended an institution that was run by Yale.
Interesting.
And I think one of his agents, I think the OSS agent who met with him, was Snowden, by the way.
Wow, fascinating. That was actually very common for a lot of those revolutionaries in the Third World to have some kind of attachment or affiliation with education in the West.
Yeah, know? And Sun Yat-sen apparently was a Freemason.
Not surprised.
Yeah, but, and this sort of national, this, you know, sort of the, how you take over a whole region to control it, and this is part of the Freemasonic way of doing it through dialectics, I guess you could say. And you could say that the disruption in hell that that Mao imposed on China was setting up for what we have in China today, sort of the Rockefeller plan, this sort of this ideal right. state capitalism, you know.
State capitalism, mass control, and total,
And that's why, population. Someone like David Rockefeller always had great words to say for Mao. You know,
so. Yeah, and the Chinese model. They love the Chinese model, yeah, because they put it together, right? The one child, all that stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. So they love that stuff. But again, what we're getting at is you had these connections to the British establishment and this connection between the occult, magic, sort of this esoteric stuff to the, sort of the
elite, really. An elitist, you know.
Having this thing, we talk about Crowley's cultural influence. And the influence of the elite, which I have with my research, and I've read the research of others, that there seems to be an agenda of whether you call it Freemasonic or not, but an agenda to sort of subject Western civilization, in particular the United States, to a sort of a cultural
culture comp, maybe
culture comp, culture war, psychological warfare.
I would say so. I mean, I think Crowley thought he was trying to make a cosmological change. He thought on very mm-hmm. broad, deep terms, in the sense that he wanted to bring an end to the age of Osiris and bring in the age of Horus, you know, this kind of hawk, war-headed god, but get Osiris represented the Christian age. And so to facilitate that change, he wanted to put people in place. He actually predicted that, he called it the birth of the child. He actually predicted that it would occur in the 60s. And it's fascinating because so many of these change agents of the 60s were people who admired Crowley and had intelligence ties. So I'll take, for example, Timothy Leary, who was this button-down psychologist who ended up at Harvard doing drug things that were sponsored by the Office of the Human Ecology. I forgot the actual name, but I think it was some CIA front.
Human Ecology Fund or something?
Yeah, Human Ecology Fund.
They're the ones that backed Ewan Cameron, right, up in Canada, right?
Yeah, so they were backing all these guys, the massive MKUltra stuff. So Timothy Leary was one piece of it at Harvard, you know, and here he is at Harvard. Who does he meet at Harvard, of all people? Aldous Huxley. And they're actually, I record their conversation in my book, Children of the Beast, because I think it's fascinating that Huxley and him had this conversation about drugs that, you know, I don't really, they have a conversation. Sometimes I think that there's pieces missing from their conversations that are more important, but Huxley had an elitist thing. Huxley actually knew Crowley, and it's rumored that they did mushrooms together. I just have to confirm it, but I know for a fact that Crowley painted a portrait of Aldous Huxley that's in a private collection, and it's not even public. It's one of those rare Crowley entity rarities that I can't find. But Huxley and Leary are together in the 60s, and Leary goes on to say, and this is kind of a famous quote from Leary, that, you know, he said on one thing, you know, I really admire Aleister Crowley. I think I'm putting into place what he had visioned. And he also said that all the changes, the major changes that happened in the 60s were sponsored by the CIA. And he was a fan of intelligence, he says. He says, oh, yeah, I like intelligence. And, you know, I think this was a change in intelligence. But he basically admits that, you know, that was something that influenced him, which I think is fascinating. And he actually spent time at this place in Millbrook that was this place in upstate New York that was run by the Hitchcock family, I think it was.
The Mellon Hitchcock.
Mellon
Hitchcock. Banking family.
Correct. So here's this banking, probably, you know.
And the Grateful intelligence Dead, by the way.
Asset. Yeah, and so all these people are there. And what happens? He leaves there and basically just starts, you know, being the Johnny Appleseed of LSD. Mm-hmm. And it's Peggy Hitchcock was her name, and a wealthy heir to the Andrew Mellon banking family. So, and they had this.
She also bankrolled the Grateful Dead.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and Alan Trist, their road manager, his father was one of the founding members of the Tavistock Institute.
Fascinating. I didn't know that. That's just amazing.
That's how these ties – I mean, it really is amazing. So when he says that, you know, the CIA created the 60s, and that's a quite an accusation. But those who have devoted research to that particular topic have connected the dots and have the evidence. That's a
– yeah.
I mean, whether it's Dave McGowan, Jan Irvin, you know, he did a thing on the The Magic Mushroom and the Life Magazine.
Right, I remember I've read Jan Irvin's thing about the Grateful Dead. That was really actually really good. But let me quote this thing that Leary said. I've been an admirer of Aleister Crowley. I think I'm carrying on much of his work that he started 100 years ago. And I think the 60s themselves. You know, Crowley said he was in favor of finding your own self and do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law under love. It's a very powerful statement. I'm sorry he's not around to appreciate the glories he started.
So there you go.
The other thing that's interesting about Leary is, you know, he thought that he had some kind of strange correlation with Crowley. He actually was in, when Crowley was in North Africa, he performed some of John Dee's magical workings, where you kind of break down the ethers, and you know, he was in there. This guy, Leary was there after he fled the United States with a drug dealer by the name of Brian Barrett, and he thought that there was some correlation. He said, "We feel we are riding the same current that powered Dr. Dee and Edward Kelly in the 16th century, and Crowley and Newberg at the beginning of this one. I see a similarity between Kelly, Newberg, Barrett, and Barrett, paralleling the one between Dee, Crowley, and Dr. Leary." So it's kind of an interesting correlation. And Timothy Leary did a lot of stuff. He had a deck of Crowley tarot cards. Here's another interesting one thing that somebody said about Leary. Timothy Leary, for example, identifies himself so entirely with the current initiated by Crowley and the coincidences and synchronicities between my life and his that he considers one of his aims to be the completion of the work of preparing the world for cosmic consciousness, which Crowley had begun.
Now, when you talk about the 60s, we talk about feminism, the sexual revolution, and when you can't talk about the sexual revolution without talking about the Rockefeller-backed Alfred Kinsey.
Not at all. You can't.
And how was he connected to Crowley?
So Kinsey himself did, you know, like very specious research. I think people who have a critical eye can tell that isn't, it has never been objectively analyzed to the proper scientific, you know, analysis. But Kinsey himself was very interested in Crowley's magical diaries. And he enlisted an early Crowley, who is still alive, believe it or not, a guy by the name of Kenneth Anger, to travel with him to Crowley's Abbey of Thelema, like we talked about, to check out the Abbey of Thelema and go to Europe and try to track down these diaries. By the way, he received from the Rockefeller Foundation at Indiana University the astronomical sum of $500,000 a year, Alfred Kinsey, in the 40s and 50s, which is incredible. But he said he was looking for the diaries. Kinsey wrote of Crowley, "Crowley was a drug addict. The doses of heroin he took and cocaine are unbelievable, and the same is true of all the sex he had." So in 52, he traveled with Kenneth Anger to the Abbey of Thelema. And there's actually in my book and kind of a famous picture of Kinsey and Anger at the Abbey of Thelema under a picture of Crowley. And I think a lot of Kinsey's ideas were actually the same kind of conclusions that Crowley had, which is encouraging people to go from heterosexual to homosexual, and that's okay, and encouraging sex with children. I think that was very similar to Crowley. Crowley thought that, you know, he wanted to break down people's reservations for this type of practices. And when he was at the Abbey of Thelema, he would encourage young children to, you know, basically watch what the adults were doing.
Yes.
And Kinsey was a nut. I mean, he should have been locked up in a mental institution. He was a very sick person. If you read the stuff that he wrote. One of his researchers, a lady by the name of Reisman, who wrote about him, said about him, "The ultimate purpose of the Kinsey reports was to prove a theory and establish a new morality." And I think that's true.
And that's what Crowley wants to do.
Exactly. So you see these correlations in outlook and behavior and this agenda that...
And it's being supported by all the establishment, the media, because here's Kinsey being put on the cover of Time magazine.
Absolutely. And they backed up all his research, and they I think if you look at it, they just gave him this kind of carte blanche. They never really questioned him as a huckster or a fraud. He really wasn't a trained sexologist. He was actually trained as a zoologist. But because he had the doctor behind his name, it gave him some kind of credibility. But he really didn't spend his time in undergraduate or graduate studying sex, you know, he just did it post work and post doctorate stuff. And I think that undermines his credibility. You know, he just basically saw a subject that he was going to, you know, become a supposed expert in.
But we can put this in the context of the time, the 1950s and 60s. This is the same time. The 50s was rather, although overtly conservative, is sort of a important changes were occurring. Of course, we have the Kinsey Report being spread, I think, 48 and early 50s, whatever, with the one on men, then on women. But you also have the introduction of Playboy magazine, which is CIA-backed, most likely.
The guy who started it, what's his name?
Effner
said that he was basically putting into practice all of Kinsey's work.
Mm-hmm. So it's being laid out, you know, like a almost like a media plan, like a promotional thing. Here's the intellectual support. Now here's the pop culture.
And then read Harry Hay. Harry Hay is this kind of founder of the gay rights movement, and he was actually at the OTO chapter of Crowley's OTO in Hollywood and kind of hung out with those type of people. But he referenced the Kinsey report as being the scientific proof to back what he did, which, you know, he was basically referencing sketchy science as something that would influence his idea of the homosexual changes in society or promote the homosexual change. And here he is also running a secret society called the Mattachine Society. So you see these similarities in these people who are promoting this kind of cultural change.
Another agent, of course, is Gloria Steinem.
Agreed.
And the CIA agent who was put in place to start the feminist movement, the Ms. magazine, and these things. Right. This also coincides with a broad cultural campaign that gets unfolded. Well, one thing is it starts in academia. But for some reason or another, why is she getting all the press? Why is Kinsey getting all the press?
Agreed. Why do some of these people today get all the press?
Yeah. You know? Why do we know who they are? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I still see that some of these people who shouldn't be get any press are promoted very, very well. And that is, there's some very astonishing people out there who get it. So, yeah.
And they're frauds.
I think that the agenda in the same type of program is happening that happened in the 50s and 60s is still happening today, I think.
So it's an agenda of cultural degradation, which goes back to what Crowley's role is I guess it's appropriate that Kinsey was a zoologist because he ultimately wants to reduce humanity to the status of animals, right?
I think so.
You know,
I would agree with that. It's an elite mentality. If you look at Crowley, Look at Liber 77, one of his big words. But if you read it, the intro says the slave shall serve. So, you know, you've got to create a slave class of servants. And how do you keep it? How do you keep the serfs in line? You degrade them with drugs.
Yeah.
All this other stuff. You break down the family so that people aren't loyal to each other. You poison their minds. And then you can rule over them, you know. And the same thing happened in the medieval era, and I think the same thing is happening now. And there are certain people who profit off of that. So,
hence you get the 60s and the 70s, right, with the feminism.
And then if you look at if you finalize the Liber 77, the thing is anybody who gets in the way of your rights, you kill them. So, you know, you can see some of these elites, I think, still have that mentality.
Well, that's the attitude of, I was talking to Dr. E. Michael Jones about this very subject. And he was talking about he made the point that morality itself is a great leveler. If you have an idea of morality, that's the one thing that the weak have. If there's a notion of general morality, but if you get rid of morality, then the weak have nothing against the powerful.
Well, that's a good point.
It's just a question of power, and right. And so the destruction of, so say, traditional or say Christian morality, it seems to be the primary target, you know, of the elite. Renders
right,
everyone
they,
a slave.
They don't. Yeah. They don't believe in that. You know.
Yeah.
They don't. They don't believe in that kind. Those kind of notions. And you know, I think that. That later, Leary himself said he was at battle against the Judeo-Christian commitment. Excuse me.
Yeah.
But he thought that he was a pagan. You know. So here he says, Leary says, we had run up against the Judeo-Christian commitment, one God to one God. One religion, one reality, that first Europe for centuries and America since our founding days. Drugs that open the mind to multiple realities inevitably lead to a polytheistic view of the universe. We sense that the time for a new humanist religion based upon intelligent, good-natured pluralism and scientific paganism had arrived.
Hmm. Yep. But that was the, people looked into the subject of the MK Ultra.
Uh-huh.
And how, of course, we hear the more lurid tales of, you know, of mind-controlled patsies, people like Sirhan Sirhan or maybe Bremer or maybe even Chapman or Hinckley. But the broader attempt of MKUltra was mass mind control. Mass mind
manipulation.
Maybe mind control is a bad term because that sounds cartoonish, but it's mass manipulation of public consciousness or behavior. That can be done anywhere through advertising, through strategy of tension, fear. We see a lot of that.
Right.
That seemed to be the main force of MKUltra. The prime interest was with it. One thing is the mass dosing of society. And that's, there's a history to that because we know what the British Empire did to China with the opium.
Right.
But the notion of introducing drugs in society, and there's indeed now there's a paper trail to prove that the CIA and other corporate bodies and interested, foundations were involved in the promotion of the use of drugs and also the importation of those very drugs.
Right. I mean, I think that they knew in the 50s that LSD, and I write about that in my book, they knew in the 50s that LSD made people docile and more pliable. Mm-hmm. And then in the 60s, here's Leary promoting it in non-clinical environments to everybody as this great, change agent.
Yeah, it goes from Operation Midnight Climax to these safe houses with George Hunter White, and they say, to the mass dosing of the rock festivals.
Yep, exactly.
And I think
it's still happening today. I think you can still trace back all of these electronica things and all these Grateful Dead events back to the mass dosing of the 60s, right?
Yeah, and it's promoted. It's not just you don't have to be at that rock festival to be affected by this. It's promoted in the media by this is supposed to be anti-establishment, and it's being promoted by the establishment.
Oh, it's incredible. Here's what Timothy Leary said about the CIA. He said the LSD movement was started by the CIA. I wouldn't be here now without the foresight of the CIA scientists. It was no accident. It was all planned and scripted by the Central Intelligence, and I'm all in favor of Central Intelligence. So, I mean, it's just a blatant statement. I don't think that there's any, question about all that stuff. So,
and this gets into things like COINTELPRO, whatever version they have out today. If you look at some of these groups,
I'm sure it's advanced 10 by 10 factor of 10.
Back then you had Weather Underground.
Right.
You
wouldn't know, or the public wouldn't know the name COINTELPRO without the Weather Underground stealing documents from an FBI office in Northern California. Mm-hmm. That's how that word was known to the public. It's a 50-year-old phrase. So I think that, the scary thing is that those have probably gone through all kinds of different iterations to different levels of sophistication.
Well, now it's probably also contracted out. I mean, I imagine whether it's through, Z or Blackwater or whatever company, or through Halo. And, so it's not specifically the CIA anymore.
Which is even more terrifying. Imagine a third-party non-governmental agency taking out or implementing dictates paid by the government.
Isn't that like if you ever watched the movie The Parallax View?
Yeah, I actually broke that up on my – if people go to my YouTube site at Occult Investigations, I cover Parallax View about 2 weeks ago because it's very important for people to watch Parallax View considering what's happening right now in the political race. So. Mm-hmm.
But this notion of this strange company that,
The Parallax Company, right?
Parallax
Corp. Yeah, which is probably in that movie was a front for intelligence of some side. But I mean, it's a great movie. That's a movie that they didn't suppress by actively doing anything. They just made sure nobody watched it and went into some kind of bin where it collected dust because nobody really talks about it anymore. It's an important movie. I think it's a great movie.
Well, I think, they put these movies out and say, hey, look, here's what our plan is. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's really good.
It's like movie. It's like Network, right? Remember Network?
Right, Network, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the original Manchurian Candidate was shelved for, 10 years? It wasn't shown to the public?
Mm-hmm.
The one with, what's his name? Frank
Sinatra. Frankenheimer directed it.
That's great. And I actually cover that because they have a scene and sequence in there where the guy goes into a trance and they actually – in the background, you can hear him say something about the number 11, the number of magic. I think it's fascinating. So Frankenheimer was keyed in. And my understanding is that Bobby Kennedy was with Frankenheimer the night before he died at the Ambassador Hotel. Did you hear that?
Yeah, didn't they have dinner with Polanski and Sharon Tate?
Something weird. I thought it was Frankenheimer, the guy who directed.
Yeah, Frankenheimer had dinner with Bobby Kennedy, Polanski, and Tate. This would have been June 68.
Yeah, crazy. That's amazing.
Literally more than a year before the murder of Tate, and, you know, over there at the Cielo Drive. Wow. Yeah, then he's, I think Frankenheimer drove him to the Ambassador Hotel.
Yeah, I think something like that. Yeah, it's wild. It's just one of those weird synchronicities. Same thing with, like, when Kennedy died, November 11th. That was the same day that Aldous Huxley died.
Or November 22nd.
C.S. Lewis. November 22nd. Thank you. Sorry.
Which has all types of, you know, numerological meaning.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah, I mean, it's a strange world we live in. There's a lot of, you know, conspiratorial stuff that takes place. Sirhan was writing about the Illuminati. He was actually had brain damage. You know that he was severely brain damaged in a jockey accident where he hit his head on the rail. And so he was, you know, on the spectrum of people who could be put into trance states. He was on the spectrum of the most easy, you know, because some people, I was told, cannot be hypnotized. And some people can be hypnotized like that. Snap your fingers. Well, that was Sirhan is that he was an easy subject.
I understand he also has ties to Bremer.
Right. I think there was a couple guys in L.A. at the time. There were tons of... Jolyon West was in L.A. All these guys were in L.A. There was a couple dudes, and they were all known to just walk around. There was one guy whose name I can't remember who, just for sport, would hypnotize people, women, men, and they were trying to make a connection between these guys and Sirhan, who lived in L.A. I think he was in Glendale or Pasadena or something. Uh-huh. So... But you know, they never made that connection. But all those guys were CIA assets. Jolyon West was an asset. I think Jolyon West became Sirhan's psychologist in jail, and that's like putting a fox in the chicken coop.
Same with what's his name, Ruby, right? Did he meet with Jack Ruby?
I think that's right. I can't.
And also, reports has it he met with Tim McVeigh. Not two minutes.
That's right. No, that's the truth. He did meet with.
Talk about a Zelig figure popping up.
Dude. Yeah, but he was super intelligent. Jolyon West was at the top of his game, and they actually have a building named after him at UCLA.
Oh, that's great. He's a great figure.
You know, the thing is that people just see one side of somebody else's personality. He was a right winger. He had if you look at some of the stuff, he got in trouble for, I forgot what he did. He did something.
He killed that elephant with LSD in front of kids.
Is that right? Yeah, he did something else. Yeah. So anyway, it's just like, you know, this has been going on for a while, man.
He has that famous quote about drugs being used to intimidate or manipulate certain ethnic groups or racial minorities.
Yeah, that's right. He said something like that. Poisoned people. Yeah.
But figures like Jolyon West or even Crowley, I mean, you could say they're similar in a sense that they're involved, whether it's hypnotism or use of pharmaceuticals, the same things that I heard Crowley used to invite people over for dinner and dose them.
You know, absolutely. He'd secretly dose people.
Yeah.
He made a joke about dosing people in New York with like the precursor to mushrooms, the same kind of psychoactive ingredient.
Yeah, so it's it's very similar. And when you get people...
And hypnotize. He knew how to hypnotize people.
This is how he convinced people he could disappear or something or vanish.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he there was like one guy who knew him in New York said he would hypnotize people and women and stuff like that. So, who was...
Which is similar to like MKUltra, which some of the sex...
I would say so.
Sex kittens or something where you can hypnotize them and let them do your will, which can, you know, like... Which is, I guess,
you could equate all of his Scarlet Women as sex kittens, really. I mean, that's what he turned them into. Branded them on their chest with the mark of the beast, and then they were basically kind of his servants for until he done them.
And hasn't the culture agenda of the past 50 years been to make women Scarlet Women in general?
I don't know. You can make that argument. I don't know. I mean, I think that
sexual revolution and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if you look, I mean, I. I wouldn't doubt it. I don't know.
I mean, if you look at TV,
you're in a society that's headed toward, you know, that the satanic values. You know?
Yeah,
I think that's where people are headed. So they're just breaking down every moral code or every barrier, and eventually that's where you'll be as Crowleyism, and that's what Crowley himself said. He told people in one of his things. He said, "What do you say?" I was not, what did he say? Here's my quote. He said something about, you know, eventually I'm going to have the world basking in Crowleyanity. 100 years from now, I will have people basking. Let me find this direct quote. I will have people basking in the sunset of Crowleyanity, is what he says. What is the date at this moment? I told him 1904. And then Crowley said, in 100 years from this day, the world will be sitting in the sunset of Crowleyanity.
Yeah, well, I mean, so if you look at society today with a illegitimacy rate of close to 40%, look at the abortion rate. How many babies have been aborted since 1973? If the overall sexual mores, public morality is such, I don't think that was an empty boast on his part.
Yeah.
Now, how does this happen? I mean, obviously, Crowley, to many people, he's sort of like a signature of hipsterism, like Che Guevara. People don't really think about it. They know that, you know, yeah, the rock stars like to talk about it. And they listen to rock music, and most people don't really emulate the life of Robert Plant or Jimmy Page. They can't afford to.
Right.
But nevertheless, the work of Akinzi, I would look at it sort of like a chemical concentrate that you pour into the overall society, and it's diluted, but it's nevertheless it has its effect. That's what's happened in society.
I think that's a great metaphor, yeah, or analogy. Yeah, I think that's kind of it. You know, you have these kind of important figures who are out there proselytizing and changing people's minds. I think Leary's one of them. Some of these musicians are definitely like that. You know, Page, Jimmy Page, and some artists.
Yeah, I remember when musicians. I was like in the eighth grade, people were reading the. Well, whether it's Jim Morrison's biography or the Led Zeppelin's biography about their light work, I remember thinking, why would you care? I mean, I got into music. I liked the Beatles like most people did, right. You know.
I did. And I love the Beatles.
I still do, you know. But I never thought that maybe it was where I was raised. I never thought that I should emulate their lifestyle.
Right.
But I just wonder, why would you want to read a book about this Dionysian lifestyle of rock stars?
Right.
Everyone knows young men in their 20s worth millions of dollars are going to have lots of women. And so my point is the whole point of promoting that is to set that standard, create that aspiration or standard.
I would agree. And I mean, I think that some of those lives are very Dionysian, like you said, you know,
yeah.
Indulgence and trying to exist that life that I don't think was there in the 50s. You know, I think things were much more fundamental. But
yeah.
I think... I mean, for example, Jim Morrison, there's a picture of him on one of his albums sitting over a bust of Aleister Crowley. Mm. And so all these people, even Charles Manson, I have in my book, what was her name? One of his followers said they studied Aleister Crowley. So Crowley is like seeded all these different people. And I think that, you know, here you have, like you said, you have this very potent figure who, you know, basically dripped into the water of the culture of the 20th century and polluted a wide variety of people and thereby... the culture and our history, you know.
But I think that figure himself was just one man. I think he himself represented a an elite or a group of people, called whether it's Freemasonic or Satanic, all the same probably. But their goal, and I think a good example is Aldous Huxley, the group that he came from, when he wrote he wrote 1932, he wrote Brave New World.
Brave New World, thank you.
You know, predicting, you know, what was going to unfold the next 3-4 decades.
Right, and just kept that consistency when he spoke at Berkeley about the same thing, the psychedelic dictatorship or whatever he said.
Yeah, and in the 1930s, general society, no way looked like it would ever go that way, right?
No, nope.
Even as late as the 50s, although if you really would examine, you had, you know, the undercurrents were there. You had the trauma of the World Wars, particularly World War II, and what it did to morality, public morality. But you do have the Kinsey Report, Playboy magazine. You have the movies. You have in the 50s and 60s, you have under the pretext of racial integration and urban renewal, the destruction of urban Catholic neighborhoods, which formed the backbone of the political strength of the Catholic.
Well, I think that it wasn't just Catholics. It was everything. Even the African-American communities were destroyed, you know?
Yeah, it's a way to break everything apart, right?
Everything was broken apart.
Yeah.
There. I mean, what was the level of marriage in the African-American community before the 60s? It was something super high.
Yes.
Like, they all were married, like 80%.
Yes.
And now, I think the marriage rate is just, it's almost like 20%. It's almost nil.
Yeah,
crazy.
It's non-existent. Yeah, and yeah, that's
not, and that was all done under the aegis of the war against poverty.
Yep, which was just really the war on poverty is really just an excuse for, I think, gentrification and removal. And
yeah.
I mean, that's how these people think. They think decades in advance, and there have been intelligence agents who have said, I mean, the former intelligence people who said that the plan is to import the drugs into some neighborhoods to drive the property values down, destroy the neighborhoods so they can gentrify it 20 years later.
Wow. I'm not surprised. It's happening in D.C. I mean, certain parts of this country, L.A.
Yeah.
Certain parts of L.A. were super drugged out, Venice, and now it's like $1 million a house.
It's a business plan.
Yeah, so I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. All these guys are together. If you look at, you know, that Aldous Huxley, what's weird also about Crowley is a lot of his followers came to Los Angeles, or people who knew him. So Aldous Huxley was in L.A. Hubbard set up Scientology in L.A. All these other people.
And they're controlling the culture.
Right. Well, here, get this.
I mean, through the movie.
There's a time. So Leary's hanging out with Huxley, but it's known that Hubbard knew Huxley in L.A. And that's an interesting element where this guy who created a mind control organization that had a lot of influence by Aleister Crowley is hanging out with Aldous Huxley, who wants to facilitate these types of change in society.
Mm-hmm.
So Hubbard and Huxley were both interested in the same thing. How can you take groups of people and change their behavior to specific outcomes? You know, it's pretty remarkable.
I alluded to it earlier, but an example of this is, of course, we have 1957 Life magazine, The Magic Mushroom, May 1957.
Right. Wasn't that Al Hubbard or something like that?
Well, the principal figure there was R. Gordon Wasson, who was the head of PR for J.P. Morgan Bank, which then reveals the corporate connection to MK Ultra. But you also have the case of Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead, his wife, who she's he's talking about weaponizing anthropology, and of course she's pushing what has been called Blue Lagoon anthropology. You're pushing free sex, free love. Of course, her methodology was as bad as Kinsey's. So you have these connections, but they're promoting the use of drugs in 1957.
Fascinating.
At the same time, this is in Life Mag, Crystal Time Life, goes back to Henry Lutz.
Right. Skull and Bones.
Skull and Bones. So there you go. 10 years later, Life Magazine, you have Paul McCartney talking about using LSD. You know?
So yeah, there you go. Here's your agenda. Same kind.
That's the Summer of Love, right? 67, and this is being unleashed. But my the point is how does these figures, although you know, how do they have popular effect? And I think we've seen it. But we get into this other case you handled, was the West Memphis 3 case. And how do we connect someone like Crowley to these three people who were eventually convicted? They were convicted, but they were set out on an Alford plea.
Right, which is a conviction. It is a guilty state. It's a statement of guilt.
The conviction stands.
They still are convicted, and they remain convicted. And they're under probation for another 5 years.
But nevertheless, these good example of rural Arkansas, these kids, this sort of these deracinated, lost youth being drawn into the, I guess you could say, the yoke. Under the yoke of Crowley. How does this happen?
I think it's fascinating in that sense. 1993, no internet, you know, this kind of middle class, lower middle class, trailer park area west of Memphis, Tennessee. You know, three young 8-year-old boys end up dead in a very strange way. They're hog-tied from wrist to ankle. They're found drowned. And one of them had their genitals cut off. And nobody really knew what to do. The police tried to start interviewing people, but they eventually got a lead that, you know, these three kids were involved. Damien Echols, he actually came into the police department, took a lie detector test, failed it, told the police, I'll tell you everything once I talk to his mom, and said, I'm not telling you anything. But they brought in Jesse Miss Kelly, who then confessed, and they were all arrested. I think it was June 5th, 1993. But there were tons of reports that came into police, and you can read through the police files, and there's all kinds of occult stuff in there. And they brought in at trial, you know, Damien Echols, the trial was in the next year, 1994, and they brought up at trial this kind of thing about Crowley. Were you involved in Crowley? And they asked him all kinds of different questions. But he said he knew about Crowley, and his response was, he was a guy who thought he was a god. So he had an understanding, and Echols was well-read in the occult. He actually admitted at trial at the time that he knew everything about the occult. And interestingly, he just wrote an article, at least this year or last year, where he said he was prosecuted because of his love of Aleister Crowley, which is an interesting statement because at the time in 1993, I don't think the police or the prosecutors knew the totality of it. But Jesse Miss Kelly confessed that they were out at this place called Stonehenge, which was a decaying old cotton gin where they did rituals and they were involved in the occult. And one of the fascinating things about this case is how groups of people can come in and twist or shape the truth of what happened. You know, these people were put in jail by 24 jurors, and HBO and the three documentaries, Paradise Lost documentaries, came out. The first one made them look pretty guilty, but the second and the third, they tried to place the blame on two differing stepfathers. One was John Mark Byers, the other is Terry Hobbs, which is interesting enough in itself because the three perps, actually it was just Damian Eccles and Jason Baldwin, said, oh, we are 100% convinced it's Terry Hobbs. And now they think it's John Mark. I mean, they were 100% sure it was Byers, and now they say it's Terry Hobbs. So they've changed their perp, which should tell you everything. But it's fascinating because all these other people who were celebrities got involved. Johnny Depp, Dave Navarro, Margaret Cho, Eddie Vedder, and Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks, and Peter Jackson, who was a film director, and financed their release. They raised something like $10 to $20 million, got the out, and eventually they just changed public perception and got out of jail on August 19th, 2011. But there, once they got out, Damian Eccles goes out and gets all these occult kind of shaped tattoos, hangs out with other occultists, gets a black sun on his back, and is essentially free, but he's out. If you look at all of his stuff that he's producing, he's creating all these occult insignia things, but the Theban alphabet with sigils on them that he's selling for people. He can't, I mean, it's hard to go get a job when you're a convicted child killer, but and remain a convicted child killer. You know, the case itself, back then there was a lot of circumstantial evidence. There's direct evidence, but I think the post-conviction confessions of Jesse Miss Kelly, if they ever played in court again, I think would be very influential to a jury. And I think that's why they took the Alford plea, and basically, which is a guilty plea. And it's just a remarkable case because most people think that they've been railroaded. But if you read the case, I think that you could come to a different conclusion. And I think that it's a phenomenon that's actually taking place in the modern culture where people go in and reanalyze cases and think that there's something shady going on. For example, it's Making of a Murderer, which is about the Avery case. And another one is Serial, which was a podcast. But if you look at the actual case files, you know, it's hard to believe that some of these people are innocent because they have direct people confessing about it. Even if the, in like, for example, the Making a Murder case, even if Dacey was found to be in violation of his constitutional rights, he admitted to being there and doing it to the police and his mom. So that's just an example. So that's basically it. I mean, I think Abomination was, you know, my book Abomination was really a statement to say, look, there's some real problems by saying these people are innocent. You might have gotten somebody who was a killer out of jail because he did, Damian Eccles, for example, had a 500-page psych report that's commonly referred to as Exhibit 500 that goes into his psych history and his institutionalization in three different psych wards, one actually in Oregon and two in Arkansas. So Abomination is pretty remarkable. It's a remarkable event. It shows the potency of celebrity opinion and PR upon the American public.
And, well, another question is, why would they rally around him so much? That's an one case in Arkansas.
It's an excellent question, and there's a lot of mystery involved in that. Why? I mean, their public statement is that this is a great injustice, but if you research some of those, I would just suggest the listeners research some of those celebrities and see what their personal interests are. I think that you'll find them very consistent with the interests of the perpetrators of the crime in West Memphis.
They share admiration of Crowley with the perpetrators?
Well, nobody's come right out and said it. Dave Navarro, for example, has a unicursal hexagram, which is something that Crowley designed. He has that tattoo on his elbow. Johnny Depp has a long-running friendship with Marilyn Manson, who says he has an affiliation with the OTO and the Process Church, or ideology of the Process Church. The rumor is all four, Damian Eccles, Henry Rollins, Johnny Depp, and Marilyn Manson all have a black sun tattoo on their back, which is similar to the iconography of some of the Nazi iconography. And I would suggest people research it. I don't have any direct proof that they're involved in secret societies, but I know that, well, for example, Damian Eccles is a member of the OTO. he's been confirmed as a member of the OTO by the OTO on their website, which is Crowley's Crowley's Secret Society.
And he moved to Salem, Massachusetts?
Correct. So once he got out, he moved to Salem because he thought that he had some affinity with the witches of the Salem witch trials. And he said, oh, I know what it's like. It's weird for him to say that because it basically admits, I think, publicly that he was involved in some kind of witchcraft. He actually had an encyclopedia of witchcraft that he wanted to read. He actually told Mara Leverett, who wrote Devil's Knot, that he wanted that book. So it's strange that he went there. It was actually an interesting part of the story because he ran into people there who actually were bright enough to read the court cases and realize there were serious problems with claims of innocence. And he actually either left town or was driven out about a year later. One of the people he ran into was the son of Peter Blatty, the writer of The Exorcist, Mike Blatty. And so Mike Blatty actually was telling people, come on, there's some serious problems here. This is a dangerous person. And so now Damien Echols is in New York, where he wrote that he wanted to turn New York into a giant magical antenna. He's been writing into like a magical book and publishing it on Instagram. So, yeah, that's currently what's been going on. And, you know, they've had these run-ins over the last 5 years. He was supposed to be on a radio show. That got canceled. He was working through Yoga Works in L.A. through a yoga studio. He was going to do a magic on the mat performance, and that got canceled because people were like, hey, there's something wrong here. So he was supposed to do a promotional thing for another company or something like that. That got canceled. And he's been seen with some interesting characters. He's been in kind of a movie. I heard that he had a problem with his probation and had to go back and talk to a probation officer back in Arkansas. I haven't confirmed that. And he's still kind of doing artwork, and he's involved in all these, just pretty interesting. The interesting thing about all three is that they obviously didn't bond in jail because they all live in separate places.
Yeah.
Damien Echols is on the East Coast. Jesse Miskelly is supposedly in kind of deep hiding or just keeping a low profile in Arkansas. And Jason Baldwin went to Washington, and he's been in Washington. And if people want to really get an insight into the case and some of the obfuscation and deceptions involved, they can go to my YouTube channel at Occult Investigations and check out some of the videos where I just obviously prove these guys are not telling the truth. They're just obvious. And it's pretty shocking, too, because some of these journalists who interview them don't even do the basic elementary reading of the court cases. So they just ask them questions and they just let them tell them whatever they want,
mm-hmm.
which is remarkable because they just don't even like know the fundamentals of the case. Why are you going to actually let them tell you what really happened? So they've actually, the sloppiness, slovenliness, and outright negligence of the American media has propagated and promoted these lies about the West Memphis Three. They just shouldn't even be working in journalism, some of these slobs. It's really incredible.
Now, your other book, was it Children of the Beast?
Yeah, that's my most recent book.
Now, that talks about, I guess, Crowley's cultural influence through popular
Correct.
Music and the movies and stuff.
Yeah,
you could say that these three characters are sort of the bastard children of Crowley, and also an entire generation who...
Definitely there's an attachment of the occult and Crowleyism into the West Memphis Three. I read Echols' Life After Death and Death book, which is his story about the time in jail, which some people who've also been in jail criticize and said, come on, this isn't true. But the guy by the name of Billy Sinclair, you can't find his articles anymore, but if you want to read his articles, they're on my Facebook page and on occultinvestigations.com. You can read his great articles about the West Memphis Three. But when I was reading Echols' book, he did something called the West Memphis Three. It was called the HGA working, which is called the Holy Guardian Angel. And it's something specific to Crowley. And Crowley himself said that his Holy Guardian Angel was Satan. So there's some hardcore ties to Crowley and in the West Memphis Three case. But my argument in Children of the Beast is that Crowley has achieved kind of to a certain extent and put a shadow over humanity to the extent that he influenced all these people to engage in certain things that he wanted, do what thou will, the promotion of magic, license of the thing about do what thou wilt, that precept is you do what you want over any effect upon other people. And it's actually in the opposite of Christ's dictum, that is, do unto others upon that what you would do it to yourself. So I do think that the ideation of Crowley has affected a lot of the culture and a lot of the people in the culture, and it's a deleterious effect.
Yeah, and we see that in popular culture all over. You see that in the various reality shows.
Oh, gee, yeah. It's
the narcissism.
And that's interesting because
psychopathy,
sociopathy, and I think that was exemplified in Crowley. And if you look at a lot of the West Memphis 3 supporters, they're just narcissistic as hell, those celebrity ones. And you see that in the modern culture. I think that that's something that's promoted as good, and I think that that is actually promoting evil as good.
Mm-hmm. Well, all these TV shows, Scandal or House of Cards, and one way to look at them is revelatory, but no, it's a promotion of evil, saying this is how it is. What are you going to do about it? This is how you get ahead in life. Even like cooking shows, like Cutthroat Kitchen, right?
That's it. I think that society is cutthroat.
Which,
hey, by the way, it's cutthroat as hell. Those people don't have any concept of looking out for anybody, and I think that is
cupcake wars.
Yeah. Oh man.
And if you do the research on that, and I think Pierce Redmond and Tom Secker out of the UK have traced that the Pentagon and CIA are heavily involved in the production of those shows.
Really? That's shocking.
So it's all culture creation.
Yeah.
Manipulation.
It's sad. I think it's unfortunate. It's good that those guys are exposing that. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. It's just, why would the Pentagon and CIA be concerned about cupcake wars? Or Naked and Afraid and all these things,
Just shaping our reality, behind the scenes. The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, and it's true. It's like an alchemical process, which brings us back to John Dee, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. The alchemy, and the alchemy comes through Crowley, and all of his followers talk about alchemy. And I talk about Yodorovsky, who is a famous film director, and Jimmy Page are all into alchemy, the alchemical process, the uniting of opposites, those types of things. Mm-hmm. And to create change, to come up with a different outcome.
Well, William, I think we covered a lot of ground tonight. I think it was a great conversation.
Likewise, man. Thank you for having me on your show.
So, where can we find your work again? Give us the rundown.
You can find my book, Signed by Me, from my website at occultinvestigations.com. I have a very active YouTube page and Facebook page. My YouTube is Occult Investigations, or you can just type in William Ramsey. I have tons of stuff on the West Memphis 3 that I think your listeners would be very interested in watching, and also put up a bunch of stuff about like Hillary Clinton's illness. But my stuff is available on Amazon, but it's much better for me if people purchase my books from my website.
And also, you've also done a lot of interviews with Ed Opperman, and you go to his site, you can catch interviews there. Would you cover in detail a lot of what we talked about tonight?
Yeah, done a lot of stuff with Ed. I'm still his producer, although I'm kind of winding down with my new show, but which is on Awake Radio on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. But all those shows are going to be on my YouTube channel too.
Great. Okay, listen, well, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, man.
And
thanks so much.
We'll talk again soon sometime?
Hopefully. Great. Thanks, Timothy. God bless.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.